shit. Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Ratchet Research, the podcast that looks at pop culture with a historical-ish lens. I'm your host, Kat, and Dee Dee is still making me do these intros, so please, please send her your hate. you can reach me on Twitter at xrecluse, E-X-R-E-C-L-U-S-E. Or you can email Dee Dee at blackgirlsquee@gmail.com with comments and hate about her making me do these intros or other things, I guess, if you want. So I'm here with Dee Dee, the co-host of Black Girl Squee. And can I just call you the founder of the Black Girl Squee Network? I think that's cute. and this week, our topic is the National Museum of African American History and Culture, colloquially known as the Blacksonian, which is literally the best nickname ever. Yay!
Yay! And that's why we had to come in on the new Black National Anthem.
Which alone is better than Lift Every Voice and Sing. I said it.
That's at X Recluse. She already spelled it out. But yeah, For Us, By Us by the gifted singer-songwriter Solange Piaget-Knowles is the new Black National Anthem.
I'm sorry, what's her name?
Piaget.
Is that her real middle name?
Yep. You know they both got French middle names.
Why do these Creoles do this?
Because they can.
It's so ratchet. Look, first of all, if you're a Creole listening to this, don't send me your hate. I'm also Creole. I'm not interested in that commentary. Because y'all know y'all a mess. Don't do it. Please don't.
Don't slander Miss Tina like that.
Do you remember her Creole look? Do you remember her Creole clothing line?
Yes, I do remember House of Darion.
So look, I don't want to dredge up the past. I want us to live in the future and the present. But when you tell me her middle name is Piaget, girl, I can't. I literally cannot. Solange been out here walking around. Girl, you know what? Let's move on. Because I love you, Solange. I love you, Mama Tina. I love you, B. I love you, Blue. Sir, Rumi, and Jay-Z, controversial opinion. Keep that to yourself. Don't at me about that either. I love all y'all, but y'all Creoles need a moment.
Anyway, tangent off the break.
My grandmama is in her grave clapping right now.
Just tangent off the break. Okay.
Off the break.
The Blacksonian.
Is that not why they're here? The Blacksonian!
Yes!
Yay!
Let's talk about that!
Okay.
You've been there how many times?
No, this is my first time. Okay, so this episode came about because I recently went to the DMV area so that I could visit the National Museum of African American History. Because
and
I
also
am...
me.
Huh?
And also visit me.
Yeah, I went there's people... no, I mean, I have friends there. Dee Dee's one of them. I saw them. It was so much fun. But I literally planned this trip around this visit because late last year, so the Blacksonian opened last year, and there were all these really great articles and podcasts about visiting it and all of that. And I wanted to go, but then late last year, like, you know, I'm sure you remember, they were like, so tickets are sold out. Plan your trip in well into the future. And so I got these tickets in April for July 3rd. Like, that's what the lead time is like now. Yeah. And, you know, I went, obviously, I'm an African-American historian. I'm also a diaspora historian. Like, I love museums. I'd heard really amazing things about it. It's the freaking Black Smithsonian. Like, there's just no, you know, I needed to go see it. So this was my first time. I'll clearly have to come again because of, we'll talk about it. But yeah, this is my first time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and you still haven't been, right?
No, I haven't. I'm a terrible, terrible
Negro
resident. Hey, you didn't have to go that far. I was going to say I was a terrible resident of the DMV, but
that's accurate you just too. Went,
you just indicting my Blackness too. Okay.
Shit. You know, I got to shame you into action.
The last time I tried to get tickets, they were looking for, they had openings in October.
Yeah.
And I kept timing out of the thing. So I was like, okay, I'll try again. Next day I try again. Oh, well, we timed out. Sorry. Try another day.
Okay. So here, let's do ticket tips, because in preparing to get these tickets, I did have to like do a little bit of like hunting on the internet to figure out the best way to do it. So first of all, if you are in the DMV area, you can get same day tickets. You just have to get there early enough. And that doesn't mean like when they open, but it does mean earlier in the day, because they have like a limited number of same day tickets. So that's one thing you can do. And especially if you're off peak, right? So like the summer is like out, let's be real. But if you're trying to go like off peak tourist at, you know, tourist times, like you could still do that. But if you are coming in from out of state or you want to like plan, release them in batches. So the most recent release was for October. And they have like, I don't remember how many dates it was, but you have to get online and then you have to like essentially, pick a date, a time, and then you end up waiting, in a queue to get the ticket. So what I ended up having to do, cause I timed out once as well. I literally opened four tabs. And I picked random dates, which is how I ended up there the day before the 4th of July, which is not a good time to do that. I was not paying attention to the dates at all. But I literally just picked like the first few dates. When I timed out of one, I opened another tab. Like I just kept doing that. And I ended up having to wait for these tickets for an hour. In the queue, like it was literally just like like the little like spinning wheel, like we're waiting, da 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 da. And the first one that hit is the one I took.
Okay, so when you say off peak, do you mean like fall?
Yeah, fall or winter. Like some, I feel like spring and summer. Because what happened when I went, which is true of all the like, you know, it's true of DC in general, but all of those museums, like you had hella families there, you had school trips there, like it was just packed, like so many kids of course too, because it's the summer and you need to figure out what to do with your little munchkins, like it was just packed. And so it's just going to be a little bit harder to like, if you want to get same day tickets or if you want to go at a time or do the like advanced tickets at a time when you're more likely to get them, like I feel like fall and winter are probably going to be your best options.
Okay. Well, thank you. The more you know.
Good luck.
I was actually
on a job interview when these tickets opened, and I was like preparing, like getting dressed in the morning, like with these multiple tabs open. And I should have been like preparing my job talk, and I was going to give a teaching demo, but I was like, yeah, no, I might not get this job, but I can't get these tickets. So you... and look, I did not get that job, but I got those, tickets. Priorities.
If you ever wanted to know what Kat was like.
This is it.
Okay. So those are ticket tips. And let's talk about the layout of the museum and how it's.
Oh, you know what? I actually have been there twice. I literally forgot that. So I actually went there in January for a conference. They had like their keynote there after the museum had closed, but I didn't see anything except for like walking into the museum and then down to the like Oprah Winfrey, like I think it's called like a theater or something like that. So that's all I saw. So I didn't see anything. So this was like my first like legit trip there. So the way that the museum is set out, like you walk into this like sort of very large like open space. It's almost dead space. I don't really know if they're gonna do anything with that, but it's literally like the help desk, the bookstore or gift shop, which I'll talk about. It looks like there's some like meeting spaces or something like that. And then you can go down one level or up two, I think two. And so I went with a friend of mine, hey Brittany, and her friend had suggested that we go to the top floor and then work our way down. And the top floor is all culture. Wait, no, it's three levels. You can go three levels up. So the top floor is all culture. So they have like music. And actually, this is a great time to say, I actually took a boatload of pictures while I was there. So if you're interested in seeing pictures from the museum, you can go on my Instagram, which is at a bit of a recluse. Maybe we could have a link to that in the show notes. And I took pictures on every floor.
Yes, you did.
You're welcome. My
And
phone died.
yes, it did. And and you had some messy captions under some of them,
You're
so
welcome. So the first, oh, speaking of, okay, so the first, the top floor is culture. So they have, like, I think it's like three or four rooms, and the main room has, like clothing, drums, what else? Hair stuff, skincare stuff, literature, and then you can go to the like the next biggest room is all music, which I think is the probably the best room in the entire museum. And they have whose Cadillac do they have on straight up display? Little Richard, somebody's big old red
Chuck Berry.
Cadillac. Chuck Berry, that's who it is. Big ass red Cadillac, like as soon as you walk into the music room. And they have really cool things in there. I can talk about that in more detail. And then they have like the TV and film and theater room, which was really cool. And just stuff like that, like sculptures, like a lot of like just small things like playbills, some costumes, things like that. And then the next room down is much more historical. And so, and I think the one of the themes there is like migration. So, but not totally. So you walk in and there's this banner from the National Council of Negro Women, Lifting as We Climb, which I've seen pictures of it, but I've seen obviously seen the emblem before, but I'd never seen the like banner, and it's really beautiful. And so they have like a printing press, you know, things like that, like a lot of like sort of interesting artifacts. And then they have like a very large section on African Americans and wartime service, which to be honest with you, I skipped because I am not particularly interested in war in general. But from what I saw, like if you're interested in like black service people, like that was a like it was really interesting. They had a lot of religious things. And not just Christianity, which I really appreciated. There's actually this one picture my friend pointed out that I had missed of these black Jews at prayer. So, like, really interesting stuff. And then they had this section on migration, which was really interesting. A random section of like black people in Martha's Vineyard. And then they have like some, you know, stuff like that. And then What else was there? There was some stuff about Black people in the North because they were sort of thinking, looking at like segregation outside of the South. There's this one really random exhibit of this woman whose name is like just totally like tripping my mind right now. I can't remember it, but she was this hat maker in like Philadelphia or something like that. And they had pictures of her hat and like pictures and actually some of her hats on display. And this like looping film of people talking about the importance of her hat shop and what it meant to have a sort of independent Black woman and sort of how a hat could, for her, sort of give to you a level of dignity. Like, it was such a beautiful exhibit. If I can remember her name and find an article, I'll send it to Dee Dee for the show notes. But it was quite, I think her son was in the video and he was crying because, she gave up so much of like her time with her family for that hat shop, because she wanted to be, you know, financially independent, her family to be financially independent and take care of her children. So they have like little gems like that, you know, sort of throughout the museum. And then they have this really large sports section, which I went through right quick because I did not care. I don't like sports, but you would like, if you like sports, because I know you do, you would love it.
Okay.
There's a whole room on Michael Jordan, which I definitely skipped.
He doesn't need a whole. Okay, never mind.
I'm hoping it's because he donated.
I don't know.
We can, because you know who else is in that sports room?
Who?
There is an exhibit to Tiger Woods, which I would like to just lodge a formal complaint.
I think he would too.
Because I'm pretty sure he didn't said, let me not put words in this man's mouth. But I just feel like his Blackness, he has put under, he has put in question more than once out of his own mouth. So That's all I'm saying.
May Reeves.
Who is that?
Is that the hat maker?
Oh, that doesn't sound familiar.
Okay.
I don't know, maybe. If it is, though. I mean, it was just a real, like, that exhibit. Like, I will say this. I kind of, I have a critique relative to this, but for me in general, like, I love museums, but especially when it's material I know a lot about, I want to see the artifacts, and so I speed through a lot of stuff, and if I stop to read and watch and listen, it's because something, like, caught my attention, like, I didn't know it, I'd never heard this particular a take on it. And I remember spending a bunch of time in that very small alcove about this hat maker because I was like, oh, I've never heard of this woman before. And it was such an interesting exhibit. Okay. So then that's the like next floor down. And then the next floor down under that, the one right above the main floor, it doesn't really have much on it, but it's going to be kind of like an interactive space that I think would be really cool, especially for students where, and, you know, obviously family historians, because it's a genealogy section.
Mm-hmm.
And what they want to do is allow African-Americans in particular to be able to trace their ancestry. And they want to give them the tools to do so.
For free?
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But it's not even open. So I can't even say like what, you know, they do or don't have. Like I was sort of looking at it like, well, I have like access to ancestry at my university. So I don't know if they're going to have anything more than that. Cause if it's just ancestry, like the whole thing about like Black family histories, like there's only so much you can do with that and et cetera. But I'm imagining that's why it's not fully developed yet, because why have that space if you're not going to offer something more than what you can get like on a place like Ancestry, or even if you're just training people on the tools, because doing Black family history is really specific. If you're training people on the tools, even that could be useful. And if it is for free and I'd imagine for school children, it probably is, especially, right? That actually is a really interesting thing. And then you go down to the main floor and then you go down to the basement, which has their Sweet Home. Is it Sweet Home Cafe? Is that what it's called? Yeah. I want to call it Sweet Honey, but I'm like, that's not what it is. It's Sweet Home Cafe, where the main chef is, or the head chef is Carla from Top Chef. I can't remember her last name.
Ah!
Although, girl, you want to check the reviews because I don't know what the reviews are like now, but when they first opened, people were like, look, like, you could get something better at your granny's house kind of thing. But I did see, but you know what? It's kind of like, duh, because I heard a podcast where they were talking about a little bit about the food. And they, part of what they were saying with, I think the head curator is that, look, like, no one's going to make greens like your grandma, right? No, like, because it's all specific. It's like where you're from in particular, like how you prefer your greens, which greens you use, how your family makes mac and cheese. I don't know if they have gumbo, but like, you know what I mean? They were like, so we tried to, as best we could, like, they were saying they really tried to, first of all, get as far as they can around the South in particular, but also to get different techniques and styles. So it's kind of like I'm imagining it as like soul food for like people who ain't got no other option. Mm. You know what I mean? So like, I'm not going to go there and be like, ooh, this gumbo tastes just like my mama's. Cause I'm going to tell you, no gumbo tastes just like my mama's. Mama, make me some gumbo. she does not listen to this podcast, by the way. So I literally just like threw that into the ether, hoping she would figure it out.
Hey, maybe the universe will find a way to send that message to her.
So they have the cafe on that bottom floor, the reflection room, and then they have a small like rotating exhibit space, which at least right now has selections from their photo archives, which are, I didn't go into that room, but I did see photos all over the museum and it's amazing. So I imagine that exhibit right now is amazing. And then they have their main exhibit, which actually goes down a level further, and it's a chronological movement from of African American history from West Africa through the present.
Wow. That's it.
That's it. It's so all. Much.
Yeah. So, that's a lot. Tell us about what is the ratio as far as men's to women's history included in the museum?
So I guess I'll sort of step back and say part of what I was doing when the museum opened is sort of thinking about or reading articles about some of the challenges they faced in putting together a collection for the museum. Because you kind of take for granted in other museums how many artifacts exist for history, right? But when you're only focusing on African Americans or Black people in the U.S., because they do move, they branch out in some ways, there aren't actually as many artifacts as you might imagine that they can access or that still exist. So part of what they did is they, first of all, culled the Smithsonian's holdings elsewhere, as well as they put the call out to other Black museums in the country to loan the material, which I really like. Mm-hmm. And then they actually, I don't remember seeing this, but apparently they put the call out to just straight up Black people. Like, do you want to donate artifacts to the museum? Mm-hmm. And so when I was there in January, I was listening to this keynote that was literal garbage. But the very best part of the keynote was this African-American man. He was talking about British history, but he started his talk talking about his own family history. And he was telling it, I think, to his grandmother, because there was a picture of his grandmother in the museum that he had donated when they had made that call. And I was like, oh, that's really amazing. The best part of his speech.
Oh, man.
Just shade.
So, really. I'm sure there are several families that mm-hmm. have artifacts just in their home that could go in the museum.
And I don't know if they're still collecting that way, but I really would kind of urge people, if you or your mother or whoever has these artifacts that you don't know what to do with, I mean, this is a really great time to donate. And people do this often, but I think Black people don't do this as often, right? They don't donate. First of all, I think that in general, like, working class people don't keep a lot of artifacts, which is a shame, right? We lose so much just based on that. And that's true regardless of race. But I think Black people in general have not donated their materials because we've been told so many times that we don't matter historically. And so you still have people who have like photographs from like 70, 80, 100, you know, 100 years ago who don't know what to do with them, right? Because they think they don't matter, or they're in the, you know, closet of some great aunt's house that no one's, you know, been in since the 80s kind of thing. And maybe you pass that history down in the family, but you don't think like this should be preserved somewhere. So this is my like historian like push to like consider, even if it's not to the Blacksonian, even your local archives or museums might be interested in that material as well.
Yes, please.
And big or small, by the
way. Yeah. Your artifacts matter.
Mm-hmm. Like there is like a there's a washing basin and a what do they call them things? What is it, a board, or you know what I mean? A washboard, girl. Good. there is a basin and a washboard in I think the top floor, and I was like, child, I would never, like, I would never wash clothes like that. But I was really surprised to see when I read the artifact or the details about it. This is from like the 1940s, I think. And I was like, what? Like, you don't really, that's not that long ago. Right. And it was, you know, still in pretty good shape. And, you know, someone somewhere has something like that. So these are things that just could be that could be donated to a local museum or archive or something like that.
So, took a step back to say,
so because of that,
that's why you think there may be a disparity.
Well, I think there's a disparity in general. So I would argue that the museum's strengths are from the Civil War on, which it seems like a long period of time, but it's really not. And because of that, there's what I call, like, so in historical research, there's called great man history, which is like presidential history or like inventors, politicians, whatever. But there's also a great Black man history. And we should be really familiar with that, because like if you know, Black History Month in school, who did you learn about? King and X and, you know, Du Bois and, you know, et cetera. Exactly. So part of what happens when we get the creation of like African American history as a topic of inquiry, or at least African Americans as a topic of inquiry, is that there's a replication of great man history into great Black man history, right? So we have all of this information about great Black men especially, and then we have the lesser inclusion of great Black women. And I think in a lot of respects, the Blacksonian does replicate that. So there are a lot of, you know, big and small, pieces or exhibits about men, which is why that one about the hat maker really sort of kind of caught me, because it was so unexpected. And it was, I think, one of the most complete of a Black woman I had never heard of. So if you've heard of the Black woman and there is an exhibit to her, it was complete. But if you'd never heard of the Black woman, if this was someone, you know, who for which they didn't have a lot of information or a lot of archives, it was like a small kind of like interlude that you couldn't really get much about her. So I was kind of shocked at that little alcove, because it felt really complete, especially because of the film that was rolling. So I think there is a replication of great Black man history in the museum. And I think the artifact issue is part of why it's like that. But I also think that that's how Black history gets presented to the masses. The entry is this great Black man. Because, like, how do we tell the story of the Montgomery bus boycott, right? Rosa Parks didn't want to get up, but whatever. She's not an activist because really it's about the birth of King, which is what I tell my students all the time. The narrative you get is about how you create a context for King emerging as an activist, right? Not the activists who created the actual movement, who are all Black women. So I think there is a replication of that great Black man history, which was really heartbreaking because it didn't have to be that way, first of all. And there were moments where, like, by the end, so the thing we did last was that kind of chronological thing. And by the end, I was, like, kind of angry. Because you step off of, or when you get to this sort of room where you hit about the 1700s, I mean, it's literally chronological. When you hit about the 1700s, you walk into this room and there's this statue of Thomas Jefferson. And it's like, come on, fam. And the actual exhibit that is a part of is about the hypocrisy of the creation of the country. So it's not lionizing. And yet here he is, right? And I was unhappy about that. I mean, and I think that's my kind of largest critique is that there's so much space given to men and men's history that you kind of lose out on how important like women have been to recording history. Women have been to kind of creating the movements, which we, you know, tend to be taught about. And how they do the work that men tend to be lionized for in these historical accounts.
And it continues to this day when you have movies like Detroit and miniseries like Guerrilla and things like that. It's like you continue to focus on the men to the detriment of all the great Black women that contributed to this history. And you said it was heartbreaking and infuriating when you saw it, but when you told me about it, I felt the same way. I was like, really? Yeah. Really? We still doing this?
And I will say it's the distinction. There's a distinction to be made about the culture, the top floor on culture and music, so many more women there. So many more. Even in television and film, so many more women there. But it's really like I didn't get the significance of what I seen until I went to that large main exhibit. And I was like, oh shit. Because there were women upstairs that didn't make it downstairs, even though there were men upstairs that made it downstairs.
Wow.
So it's just something to think about.
Wow, that hurts.
Thanks.
Yeah. So did you want to talk about some of the missing cultural figures?
First of all, yes, Beyonce.
Giselle knows Carter.
Now see, Giselle ain't Piaget. Do you see how we could have like, that's fine. We're gonna move on. So I like literally walked out of the music section and my friend was actually better at this than me, pointing out who was not there. I think the very first thing she said was, where's Josephine Baker? And I was like, girl, what? So if you don't know me, I'm obsessed with Josephine Baker. Obsessed. There's actually that really famous like watercolor of her in the banana skirt hanging outside my office that I got when I was in Paris. I was like so excited. I'm obsessed with Josephine Baker. And I literally was like, girl, where is Josephine Baker? But then I was like, she shouldn't be in music. She should be in theater, which is where we found her. However, there was like
she should also be downstairs too.
Well, girl, first of all, actually, we'll talk about that in a second. And she, we'll talk about that in a second. So when we found her in theater, it was like, I want to say like a painting or something of her on a wall. And my friend was like, you mean they couldn't have just gotten a banana skirt made? And I was like, yeah, that's kind of ridiculous. Because actually, let's make this point. A whole bunch of the artifacts in the museum are facsimiles. They are not historical. And that really pissed me off because, one, I think they were not as clear as they could have been about what's a facsimile and what's not. But then if you're going to have facsimiles, make a goddamn banana skirt. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, how do you not do that? Yeah, so I was, so that was the first thing my friend noticed. And then we walked out of the, and she noticed other things. And then we walked out of the music section and I was like, did you see Beyonce? And she was like, no. And I literally was like, I'm not walking any further until I figure out what's happening. And I like Googled it and I found this tweet from the museum because someone straight up asked them last year, you know, do you have anything from Beyonce? And they said that they hadn't been able to acquire anything from her. And I don't know if they had tried to and she said no or if they just sort of left that alone. But there's nothing in there from Beyonce or Jay-Z, which I think are like huge omissions, especially because we know Beyonce has an archivist.
Yeah.
And so to imagine you couldn't get something loaned, I don't know, but it was an omission.
I cannot see her saying no to the Blacksonian. I don't, like, not even in an alternate universe would I ever see. Yeah, I don't see it.
Yeah, neither can I. And look, I mean, I think that there's a chance, you know, I don't know if they donated to it or not, but I think that, look, there's a Michael Jordan room we don't need, first of all. Mm-hmm. So we can have a Beyonce room that we do need.
Yes.
Is all I'm saying. Even if it's like us in the special collections room downstairs where they just have some of her stuff on display for a limited period of time. Like, she literally had a display of her dresses from Lemonade, like, or her costumes from Lemonade. Like, that would be an amazing rotating, you know, exhibit. So I don't know if they're working on anything, but it did stick out.
Use some of the pictures from the coffee table book. I mean,
have the coffee table book.
You can have a Lemonade exhibit just on Lemonade within the entire Beyonce exhibit because it's got to be bigger than Lemonade. But you could have because the photography, the cinematography in that video, in that piece was iconic.
Mm-hmm. They could even have an exhibit on the elevator trilogy. Is what I'm calling it.
Oh my God. Oh my God. You went there.
Okay. Someone else made like that tweet and I was like, this is amazing. The elevator. I don't know if they called it that, but literally.
Shout out to that elevator.
Shout out to that elevator because yeah, that would be amazing. This is a free idea they can have.
And messy.
It's a free and messy idea that they can have.
That'd be the messiest museum exhibit, Lord.
And they will be sold. I mean, the tickets are free, but they will be sold out for the entire run.
Oh my God. Okay.
Could you imagine?
I can imagine. You are a mess. What they're going to have, they're going to have the security footage run into?
Oh, iconic. Oh my God. Oh my God. And then they could just like intersperse the security footage with like images from the albums too. And they could have, oh man. And they could have like, you know, some select songs from the albums playing. Like, could you imagine like I Ain't Sorry playing as they like zoomed in on Beyonce staying the fuck out of her brother and husband or her husband and sister fighting? Could you imagine?
Oh my God.
Could you imagine? Just like Sorry playing and she's just sitting here like, don't touch my dress. And then when she steps in, right, then you switch to like Solange. God, what would be a good...
Don't you wait.
Girl, do it, right? And then when Jay-Z gets in the car by himself, you start playing 444. Like, this is literally... I need to make this
film. Oh my God, it's writing itself. Oh
I need
God.
To make this film and then launch my next career.
Oh my God. Put in a call to TMZ for the video and you're
TMZ,
set.
BET can play this right now. Like,
Oh my dear.
VH1, somebody is gonna play this.
Yeah, somebody that never wants Beyonce or
Oh, so
anybody else on their channel again.
BET.
No, I think they would like Beyonce to come back and perform
I think that
someday.
they are trifling, so they will get real reckless and then whine the next year because she's not coming back.
Well, yeah, they did pretty much ensure that Onika Mirage will never appear on their network again.
I guess that's a loss. I don't really know.
You all righty, moving
This is a
on
different
to
caliber. Look.
yes. Moving swiftly on
Don't come
to
for
the
me, Nicki
cat.
Minaj fans. Y'all need Jesus. Leave me alone.
Oh, the cafe.
Oh, okay.
Let's move on.
So there are like people omissions, but the Josephine Baker and Beyonce are the two that I noticed and remember like saltily to this day. The other thing that I think they're missing, and this again is a free idea, take it. So after, so we got to the museum around like, I don't know, like 12 something or whatever, 1 o'clock, and I did not eat breakfast because I'm an idiot. And I obviously didn't eat lunch. And we were like meeting Dee Dee and our other friend Gabby for dinner. But there was like a half an hour between like when we were leaving the museum and when we were going to meet our friends. And I was hungry as shit. Like, I was one of those damn sticker commercials. Like, I was literally like, oh my God. And we stopped and looked at the menu for the cafe, but they were all just straight up meals. And I was like, look, they are missing out on a different tier of food. They need to have, please take this, a bagged lunch with a piece of fried chicken. My friend said a slice of bread. And I was like, okay, but give me a biscuit. Like, let's be real. So a piece of fried chicken wrapped in wax paper, some kind of bread or biscuit, and then I'll buy a can of soda. That is the most historically accurate lunch, bag lunch they could ever have in a black museum. And the fact that they didn't have it was kind of like, y'all not trying to get my little bit of money. So.
It's got to be a biscuit. Chicken and biscuits are like peanut butter and chocolate.
I
They
think
go
historically,
together.
though, it was actually a piece of bread, though. Like they would actually just wrap the chicken in the bread and then put that in wax
Oh.
paper. Because I mean, it makes sense, right? But yeah, for me, it's got to be a biscuit too. I don't need just stale ass white bread.
Yeah. And then biscuits better be soft and delicious.
Well, look, they ain't your mama's biscuits. Like, let it go. That should be their tagline. It ain't your mama's food. Chill. Like we don't know your Auntie Roni. Like we can't make like her mac and cheese. Let me live.
So, free suggestions. Just credit at X Recluse
Me a
for
job.
the generation, yeah,
Yeah.
and leave it at that. But yeah, that's definitely a good idea. You need some portable food in the museum to honor the activists before us. And also, yeah, you just need, yeah, chicken.
Chicken, because I did want to try their fried chicken. Because I'm like lenient with fried chicken. Like, I realized it could taste a lot of different ways, but I really wanted to try their fried chicken and I didn't have time.
Oh, this kind of follows up from the Great Black Man History discussion, but making African American history palatable for the masses. What's involved with that? What are the decisions made behind what's featured and what's not featured in order to make history palatable for people that aren't even us?
Yeah. So I think that that was the thing that, like, in the back of my mind, I don't even think I fully understood that I was interested in that until I was in the museum. But yeah, the sort of narrative of the museum was what I was interested in. And I'm not surprised that they took this particular tack, but there is, so there's a kind of history called recovery history. And I think their narrative aligns to this. And recovery history is essentially just, we don't know what was happening. And so we want to know with a particular population or in a particular time period. And so you go back and you get the basic facts, right? Who people were, how many people were there, where they lived, stuff like that, right? Just really basic stuff. And I really like recovery history, actually. But the sort of narrative you get out of that, especially for African-American history, is that you have like a large framework of American history. And then what you say is, this is where Black people were at all of these phases. Does that make sense?
A little bit, yeah.
So you essentially are like, okay, well, the British came here, came to the, you know, East Coast at this time period. Where were Black people? Were they there? Were they not there? If they weren't there, when did they come? At the founding of the nation, you do the same thing, right? Like, what's the population of Black people? Who serves? How many people serve in the war? Any interesting stories that we can articulate? War in general, like, where are Black people there? And you essentially insert African Americans into the larger narrative of American history. And so it made sense that the Blacksonian does that because it's surrounded by other museums documenting American history from various aspects. And so if you went to all of those museums, realistically, you would get a well-rounded history of American history, but it would all be based on a particular narrative that is about white people, right? Mm. Because they have all the signposts of white people, right? Jamestown, right? Franklin and Washington and Jefferson and founding fathers and the Civil War and Reconstruction. I mean, all of these things are sort of like, you know, sort of signposts of American history. And you just say, okay, well, in Reconstruction, here's what Black people were doing. Or in Reconstruction, here's what Native Americans were doing. Or with the railroads, like, here are the Chinese Americans, here are Filipinos, here, you know what I mean? Like, here are the Irish Americans. You do this thing where the structure of American history allows for you to insert and recover particular narratives that aren't mainstream or, you know, really well known. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But there is another way to do it that the museum does not do. So when I teach straight up AFAM history courses, I tell my students that American history and African American history are not parallel. Sometimes they intersect, but sometimes they don't. So when you start with American history, chances are you either start at contact between Europeans and the indigenous people who inhabited this land before that, or you start in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you start American history or African American history, I mean, where do you start?
Wow.
This is like a history lesson.
I mean, most people start at slavery.
No.
Don't? They don't?
No.
Okay.
Nowadays, if you, every African American history course you take, unless, never mind, let me not say that. Every African American history course you take should begin in West Africa.
I mean, should, but.
But I mean, it does. Like, and I,
okay.
Yeah, all right. I'm. So the thing I was going to say, but I didn't say, is unless your professor is an idiot. Like, but I didn't want to say that. And so you made me say it, Dee Dee. You did.
Anyway, go ahead.
Unless your professor is an idiot and not trained in the field, you should start an African-American history course in West Africa, period. But before the introduction of African-American history as a field of inquiry, you would start at slavery. But if you don't start at slavery, then what you have, if you start in West Africa and you go through an African-American historical narrative, you are interested in West Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America, you're interested in the diaspora, right? And so there are moments where the Blacksonian does that, but for the most part, it really is conforming to a narrative of inserting African Americans into the larger field. And I think I'm not surprised at that, because if you imagine that if the audience is not black, right? Solely black people, then what you need to do is create a signpost that they're familiar with. So little white kids who are not getting African American history in middle school can come there and see, they walk out into that room and they see Jefferson and they're like, I know the narrative here. And then they walk around the exhibit and it's like, oh, actually, here's, why are we talking about the Haitian Revolution? Oh, that matters. You know, here you have Phyllis Wheatley, right? Why does that matter? And so they are kind of turning that narrative on its head, but it's an inclusion narrative, right? And so they're doing, to make it palatable for like the masses, what they have to do is provide as an entry point a narrative you're familiar with, and then tell you how Black people fit into it. And I don't have a problem with that, but I do think that that's a different narrative than focusing solely on Black people, right? Because for me, having this large statue of Jefferson is a problem, because now that I'm saying that, I don't think I ever saw Sally Hemings. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on this, but I have no memory of seeing Sally Hemings. But if you start if it's an African American history course, I don't start with Jefferson. I start with Sally as a way to understand Jefferson, right? Because if you start with Jefferson as a way to understand Sally, it's a whole different narrative.
So yeah, why wasn't Josephine Baker downstairs?
I have no memory of her downstairs. Yeah, I don't even know. I don't even know.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't, like, I'm sure I saw Billie Holiday, but I didn't see Ma Rainey. Like, it's just, like, if you really think about, and especially for me, I'm also a women's historian, so women are the thing, right? I'm literally just like, are they here? Like, they're the perpetual question. And it's like, I want to see Ida B. Wells. I 100% want to see Ida B. Wells, right? And I see her, but do I see her contemporaries? Because it wasn't just her, right? So you see Du Bois and you see all of these other men of the sort of turn of the 20th century. And I can't imagine they didn't have Ida B. Wells, but I don't see T. Thomas Fortune either. I don't, you know, see later Anna Arnold Hedgeman. Like, if you can just think of these sort of random, I don't know that I see Asada. Like, I don't, like, I think you could sort of go on and on to these people who aren't mainstream, right? And you don't really see them there, even though they have become, for Black people, popularly really important. And so there was just this moment where, as I was walking through the museum, where I'm just like, in some ways, this is a sanitized version of Black history. And even though I know why they would do that in this space, it's still frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you would think that we'd be the audience, but it's never just us.
Yeah,
it's never really for us by us, is it?
It's not. I mean, and I don't. It wasn't. It wasn't. I feel sad.
Oh, sorry. But let's talk about something happy. Let's talk about the visitors that the people that came to the Blacksonian when you were there, and some of their reactions. Those made you happy, right?
Yeah, so first of all, I think I was expecting it to be mostly Black people. And it was entirely mostly Black people, but there were, like, you know, a good portion of white people, domestic and foreign, by the way. I saw a lot of, like, Asian people. I don't know if they were Asian or Asian American, but I saw a lot of Asian visitors. But the vast majority of visitors that I saw were Black. And it was so fun because it was multi-generational. And so, especially in the culture floor, there was a lot of parents teaching their children out of their own experience. So like in the TV section, there's a small thing on comedians, and there is, I think, a loop of video of Red Fox playing. Mm-hmm. And this, I'm assuming a father said to his son, "This is what your grandfather used to watch." And I was just like, oh my God. Oh. Like, do you know what I mean? And then there is this music section that's kind of dealing with the 90s. Like, it was dealing with various things, but they had, I think they were playing SWV when I walked in, and I got My Whole Entire Life, but... and they had literally like cassettes on display, but also 8-tracks and vinyl and stuff like that. And so I saw this mother say to, I'm assuming her son, this is an 8-track. And then this other woman said, they got 8-tracks? Like, it was just nice. And then they had some, you know, those like, not shell, those bamboo earrings.
Yeah.
They had some on display with a whole outfit. And this woman said, that's how I used to dress. And I think she was talking to like a child near her. And then this other woman said, oh my God, bamboo earrings. And then my friend said, oh, they're coming back in the style. And I was like, yeah, I have a pair. And she was like, what? Like, she literally was looking like, girl, what are you talking about?
Oh my God.
And then there was like, my friend was eavesdropping on this person. They had like this literal thing on this exhibit on skin bleaching creams. And my friend was eavesdropping on this man telling, I think his girlfriend, he talking about skin bleaching. And she said he was saying some messy, like inaccurate stuff. I didn't hear it. But I was like dying laughing that they literally had skin bleaching creams in an exhibit. So, yeah, it was just like a lot of like, I was so like geeked out, especially in the upper floors, with how many parents and grandparents and kids who were like using the museum, not just to like immerse their kid or like show their kids their culture, but also to sort of place themselves in history, which is the, since what they have is more modern anyway, it was super cool to see that it allowed for that. Because, like, I look back at that wash tub and the washboard, and I did exactly what everyone else did. I thought, oh, my grandmother would have grown up doing this. Do you know what I mean? And so it was really nice to sort of see that we could all kind of have this moment where, like, oh, this is how I can understand this history in my own context.
doesn't that just warm your heart?
I don't have a heart, but yes.
So that was good. You said there were a few people that were surprised to see this many black exhibits.
So I will say that apparently my friend had all the messy like observations. I was like just geeked out like as a history nerd, but right. Hilarious. We were taking the escalator up to the top floor, and we saw this this like kind of like angry looking white man, and she just made a joke, but she was like, he looks so mad to see that there are all these black people here, and we just started like cackling because there did seem to be some white people who were kind of like, why are all these Negroes in the Negro Museum? And it was like so funny.
Right.
At least that's how we processed the looks they were giving us.
Yeah.
Oh well.
Yeah. You knew what it was when you bought a ticket to the National Museum of African American History. African American history. Anyway.
But see, like, this is actually, okay, so I'm going to, like, go on a mini rant about revisionist history, because this is the life. there's this way in which, like, the narrative we have about revisionist history on the internet is incorrect. We tend to talk about revisionist history as distorting history, right? Like, am I wrong about how that's how it's sometimes used on the internet? Mm-hmm. I am wrong, or that does that like sound familiar?
Revisionist, like, basically editing and changing the story.
Yeah.
That's how it's commonly.
Yeah. But in the field of history, that's not actually what revisionist history is. Revisionist history is expanding that narrative of great man history. So in that respect, if you can name a Black historian who's either still working now or has worked since the 1960s, they're all revisionist historians. Because what we're revising is an inaccurate narrative, not the history. So not we're not limiting the history, we're literally expanding it. And so I get kind of frustrated when I see that, because if we don't understand that, then we don't understand why our history books at below college look the way that they do, right? Because, so I don't know if I've done this. I need to stop giving these history lessons, first of all. But African-American history as a field doesn't exist until the 1960s, first of all. And a lot of the historians who helped create that field and the later Black women's history are coming out of the Civil Rights and Black Power movement, right? But their histories, it takes a good few decades to change, like, the narrative in history books. But at the high school level and below, you don't see that same revisionist expansion of the historical narrative. And so you can have these white people walking into this museum about African-American history expecting to see happy slaves.
Oh, God.
Because at some point in their education, I guarantee you, someone gave them the happy slave narrative. Or they don't, it's not called the happy slave narrative. Now it, what we see is the use of, and this is an older narrative as well, but we see the use of paternalism, right? People have imagined that paternalist slavery was benevolent, right? And again, that's an old narrative, but it's one that's been harder to dislodge. So we now can say, for the most part, slaves were not happy in the way that white people imagined that they were, right? But I still see people, my students included, who were like, well, some white people thought of their slaves as family. Okay. It doesn't matter what they thought of, right? What matters is what their slaves thought, right? What the enslaved people actually felt about these relationships, because they didn't think of it as family at all. And so you can have these white men and women who my friend and I were imagining were like so pressed about all these Black people, because their particular narrative of African-American history or Black people in American history has been taught to them in a particular way that one, real Black people don't actually exist, right? We don't have actual, like, we're not human beings with, like, motivations and feelings, etc. But also, they want a particular narrative that doesn't have to challenge how they feel about themselves. And so when you have, like, actual Black people getting emotional, like, in front of chains, right? That challenges a particular narrative about how you feel about history. Because you can have white people who are like, oh, this is so terrible, this is hard. And then you can have Black people, like, weeping in the corner. Which is why, by the way, they have the reflection room at the end of that final exhibit. Because they know that that larger exhibit is difficult. And they want you, if you need to be able to sit in that room. There's, like, water falling from this water feature in the air. They want you to sit there and be able to think and reflect and decompress. I can't think of another museum that has that, right? But they have that. They have that because I think in that moment, they really are thinking of their Black visitors, right? What is it going to be like to have to walk through your history and then just walk out into the world again? Maybe you shouldn't do that. Maybe you need a moment.
Yeah. Good idea. Good job, Blacksonian. I give you a point for that. That's good.
I mean, there's so much I loved about the museum. And I do think they really did try to balance that Black visitor versus non-Black visitor. And I think this is one of the ways where they were keeping their Black visitors in mind, not just Black people, as if we're the only ones who would be emotional, but certainly we would be emotional, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think there's a way in which we have taught history, especially at the middle school and high school level, that Black people are caricatures or ghosts of who they actually are. And so when you're confronted not just with like a history and a culture, these artifacts, but also real Black people for whom this is not abstract, it is their own history. I think I don't feel bad that my friend and I were imagining that there were like hostile white people.
Yeah. Hey. And if you got a chuckle out of it, it was worth it.
There you go.
Last thing we wanted to talk about before we leave for the day is we started with ticket tips. Let's talk about museum etiquette. I think you had a word, Sister Cat.
All right, I'm going to start with a rant before I give you my word.
Here we go.
So part of the reason why I have to go back is because the one exhibit I wanted to see was the Emmett Till Memorial, mm-hmm. where they actually have his casket on display. And they tell you when you're like queued up to see that final exhibit in the bottom floor, they tell you that you can't take pictures there, you know, at the request of the family. And I think actually that exhibit too is partially why they have the reflection room. I'm currently working on a piece about Black mothers and mourning their slain Black sons. And I really wanted to see that just for my own self, but also for the work that I'm, you know, doing right now. I really wanted to see his casket. We spent 3 hours in the museum. We like had 15 minutes before we needed to leave. And we, at the end of that chronological thing or near the end of that chronological section, we hit, you know, the 1950s and we were like, and there is the Emmett Till Memorial, the entrance. And we see a line and there's a security guard and he says, yeah, it's, you know, the line starts that way. So we walk a little bit behind and we see this like, you know, I think it's a Pullman Porter train and there's a line there and we're like, what the hell? And my friend asks this other security guard, she says, does it go around the train? And he's like, yeah. And so we go to the back of the train and there is a line extending there. So to get through that train, to get to that line, yeah. At least a half an hour. I would argue that it was probably, you know, maybe a little closer to 45 minutes, but at least a half an hour, we're going to have to stand in that line. And I was so like, hold the fuck, excuse my language. I was like, hold the fuck up. Why did no one tell us that we had to queue up to go into this memorial? They told us we couldn't take, you know, pictures there. They told us, you know, all of this stuff about the memorial, except that we had to queue up. And I was like, I wasted 20-30 minutes like dodging through people at all of the other exhibits, which were, you know, some good, some not so good. And the one thing I wanted to see was the only thing I could not see. And so I was a little bit pissy about that. And I was like, why is the line taking so long? And I was like, they have a security guard there, but they're not like sort of getting you through. And I think they just don't want to press you or, you know, push you, which I understand, but it's like, there's a line behind you, right? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So this leads me to my word about museum etiquette. I was a little shocked as I was walking through the museum at how people in general, like, were not respecting that a museum is a communal space. And because it's a communal space, there are some things you do and don't do there. And the big thing was how you make it possible for people to see the exhibits, right? So there are a lot of people crowding around an exhibit really closely, meaning that you couldn't see. So you ended up having to wait behind them until they moved, right? But then it also meant you were you know, usually blocking a walkway. And then you had a lot of people who would just stop. And this is just people in general, honestly, this part. They would just stop in the middle of a walkway.
People do that in the grocery store too, but.
And that is my general life pet peeve. But so, you know, there was a lot of like we got caught up in bottlenecks is like everywhere because people were not like, they would not just look around them and sort of say, hey, like I need to get something out of my purse. Let me move to the side. Like, and myself included, by the way, I'm not saying everyone should be perfect with this, but I'm really self-conscious physically in public. And so like, it kind of wild. It was like a little wild to me that people weren't like, just literally just turning and looking around to see if they were in someone's way or whatever. And then they would like, so the last exhibit, which is when the last exhibit I saw was the Obama exhibit, which was not good, by the way. But it was essentially like this large, like, collection of like, I think they had like a dress, a Michelle Obama dress from, I think the first inauguration maybe. And then they had like a bunch of like campaign stickers and shit. I was like, this is weird. And, but so it was like big enough, like it was kind of like a window into like a, sorry, I just threw my headphones off. It was like a window into a small room. And so I'm trying to see it and I'm standing off to the right. And there's this woman like walks right in between me and this other woman who are off to the side. She walks right in between us, gets hella close, and then takes a picture and then stands there. And so I'm sitting here on the side like, well, ma'am, can your ass move? Because me and these other people who were a respectable different distance away now can't see because you're trying to press your nose up to the glass. Do you know what I mean? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, what the hell? And I don't want to say that everyone did that. Like, people were really nice. Like, when someone was stepping back to take a picture, people would wait on either side, which is like basic museum etiquette. But you would just see like a lot of people who, especially in the music room, because it's kind of cramped, like we were like, people would just sort of stand super closely. And I remember I was trying to get like, I was trying to see this Parliament Funkadelic. I think they had like a George Clinton like jumpsuit. Mess. I think it says sex. It did say sex. Mess. George Clinton. Exactly. And then they even had his wig, which I thought was a girl. I can't. Let me stop. So I was trying to get to that to see that. But there was like these glass cases and then the wall. And there was this person standing like smack in the middle between a glass case and a wall. And like, I thought they were taking a picture. I don't know why I thought that because they literally would just stand there, like standing there looking at the exhibit and I'm on one side and this other woman's on the other side. And we're both kind of like waiting to see if they're going to take a picture. And then they can see it. They have to be able to see us in their peripheral vision, but we're just like standing there like, I mean, are you going to take a picture or move? And finally, I was like, I'm over it. So I had to walk around, it's not far, but around a glass case to end up on the other side of that person who was just standing there. And as soon as I got on the other side of them, they turned and walked away. I was like, can you just move? Like, I'm just, so this is, so first of all, if you want to know how salty I am in real life, this is that. Like, this isn't even like coherent, but I just remember being super pissy because a lot of people just did not have like good museum etiquette, as I would call it, where essentially all I mean is that they were just cognizant of the fact that there were other people around them.
Yeah. I don't get that, but then, yeah, I don't get most people. Can you go? Yeah. So, yeah. So, if you're headed to a museum, please always remember you're not the only one there.
Unless you are and you're, you know, and you're really lucky. And I mean, I will say this too, like, just to be fair, it was the July 3rd. Like, the museum was absolutely packed. And, like, I don't know if it would be different, but I felt like people I know who went, they were like, it's such an experience. And I had some of that. Like, there were so many moments where I was just totally geeked out and, like, really emotional. So many favorite exhibits, for sure. And I really liked the spaces. But there was just a lot of people just being really just not conscious of the fact that they were sharing the space. And that's just a little bit of a pet peeve, because I really feel like you can have this moment and this connection in a museum with straight up strangers where you are experiencing this thing together. And I definitely got some of that, like the whole bamboo earring thing and, you know, the people telling their kids and kind of just being able to eavesdrop on that. But I also got a lot of people just being a little stingy with the space.
But all in all, you did enjoy your visit, and you said you are going to be back.
I am going back, if for no other reason than to see the Emmett Till Memorial. But yeah, I mean, it was so much fun. It's the only trip I had planned for this summer. And I was telling all of my colleagues that I was going, and they were like, oh my God, that's so cool. Because we're like history nerds, you know, in general. But yeah, I mean, I really liked it. So I guess before I leave, people are like, damn, why does she have all that terrible shit to say? Like, this bitch needs to calm down. I do need to calm down. But the point is... But these are the critiques of a historian. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
My friend didn't have as many critiques she didn't have these critiques for sure, especially the one about narrative. That's me being like nitpicky. But these are the critiques of a historian who is familiar with the history. And so some of it was a little bit more redundant than it necessarily was going to be for someone else. And I had like high hopes, and I would say that those hopes were certainly met, but there were some things that I was like, you know, they could have done this better, or they could have considered this, or like people in general, including myself, could have been more conscious of the space in general. But I'm excited to see when I go again, if I feel the same way about that, because it could be that I walk through them as, I think this is the other thing about layout. You know, millions of miles ago that we were talking about this, you experience the museum however you walk through it, right? So if I had walked through the museum in a different way, I might not have had the same critiques. And so it'll be interesting to see when I go back, and I will purposefully see it a different way, start a different floor or something like that. I'm really interested to see what will happen to my own engagement with it at a different time.
And hey, hopefully by that time they will have added some more women.
Well, maybe some of y'all will have donated some artifacts for them.
Exactly. Fingers crossed. So that is Ratchet Research for this episode. Thank you for all of your wonderful comments and ideas, Kat. You can find her at xrecluse.
You can tell me I'm being salty. It's okay. I mean, I might not respond to you, but you're free to tell me that I'm being salty.
I will remember that. For future salty episodes, you can find her pictures of the Blacksonian on her Instagram, which is at a bit of a recluse. I'm at Dust Daughter, and you can also email about the show at blackgirlsquee@gmail.com. So until next time, bye.
Bye.